Welcome to the Eastman Dental Podcast, where we hope to inspire, motivate, and provide education from our guests' experience.
Wow, Julia, what an inspiring episode from this week's guest, Faye Donald.
Yeah, she's had quite a dental journey, hasn't she? I mean, really, to share all of those details, I think was very, very special.
Yeah, and I think there's a huge amount of benefit that our listeners will get from that in terms of putting into context their own experiences and the struggles that they might be having as well.
And I think her view on the study club and its inception and what it can bring to people, I think, really helpful.
I can't wait for our listeners to hear. So sit back and relax.
With your hosts, Josh Hudson and Julia Bruin.
Welcome to the podcast, Faye. It's really lovely to have you here for your interview.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about me and my journey. I hope it will be interesting for you and your listeners.
Sure it will.
So obviously you've had quite a varied and actually a very successful career. And so we always sort of start these questions off by asking people how it all began. So how did it all begin with you?
Goodness me. Well, I think that like a lot of dental hygienists and therapists of my generation, we all seemed to kind of fall into dentistry. You know, we looked through the newspaper and there was a dental nursing job and we thought we'd give that a whirl. And I was very much that generation. But it didn't take me very long to realise that I definitely had wings that needed to be spread a little further. And I loved being a dental nurse. I mean, back in those days, often you were a two-man band. It was me and the dentist. I was receptionist. I was, you know, almost radiographer bar pressing the button. You know, I was counsellor. I was everything, dental nurse, everything. I remember my boss and I used to iron his shirts for him and, you know, everything laid out and I just loved, I was his
PA. And it sounds like he probably loved you. I mean, goodness, you didn't end up marrying him then.
Definitely not, no. But I was very much his PA and I do remember going off for the interview at dental school and back then you had an interview, they offered you a position pretty much there and then they rang me that evening and said, you know, you're great, we'd love to offer you a place pending references. So at the time you needed to have two good references. So I didn't tell my boss and a couple of days later I noticed the letter come through from Leeds Dental Institute and I opened all his mail for him. So I opened this letter and sure enough, we've had Faye, we've offered a place we'd like. And I didn't tell him. So I took the letter and hid it in my pocket. And I probably had the letter for maybe even about a week. And every day I thought, I'll do it today. I'll tell him today. I'll tell him today. And of course, there was always some crisis. I don't know. Whatever had happened at home or whatever, never felt like the right. And eventually I had to say, I've got something to tell you. And of course it was nothing but utterly supportive and remains a really good friend today. Every now and again, I'll bump into him at the shows and he'll sort of say, I knew it. I knew you were destined for great things. But I think like lots of people of my generation, we didn't really know what we were getting into or why we particularly went, perhaps personality-wise, we were suited for the healthcare profession. But I'm pretty sure if you could have answered an advert to be a midwife, I would have answered that advert as well. You know, it was just one of those industries that you could get into quite easily back then. And I do remember wanting to find my place and wanting to find something. I remember being as a smaller child, early teens, my grandfather, who had a really big influence in my life, was a gardener. And I used to go with him and help him to clear kind of the chopped leaves and whatever else it was that he was doing and help him. And I didn't enjoy it very much. And he obviously knew. But he paid me. He paid me a whole 50 pence. And I come from a real working class family where, you know, we didn't sort of have pocket money and things. So I had to get my 50 pences wherever I could get them. And this particular day, and I remember it vividly now, 30, 40 years later, this particular day showed me this £5 note, and it was more money than I'd ever seen in my whole life. And it would be like showing me £1 million now, I think, at the time. I thought I'd be able to buy a house with it. It was just so much money. And he said to me, if you do the clearance yourself today, if you do this garden all by yourself today, you can have all of this money. You can have all of this £5. And I couldn't believe, I mean, it was just more money than I could ever imagine seeing in my life. So, of course, I set to work and I was going to do it. And it remains one of the worst days that I've ever had. I hated every moment of it. It was freezing cold. It was really hard work. And every time I tried to kind of cut a corner, he would say, you haven't done it right, go back, do it right. You've missed a bit. You need to do a bit more there. And sure enough, by the end of the day, as you can imagine, as a stroppy teenager, I had my arms folded and I was quiet and I was angry and I didn't want to talk to him and I didn't want his silly £5 note. And, you know, I was utterly fed up. And he handled it really well and left me to have a little sulk. But I remember a couple of hours later when Dad came to pick me up from my granddad's house, just as I was leaving, I never forget. I can remember the way the hall looked. I can remember the way it smelt. He knelt down and he sort of uncurled my hand. My fist was still curled up because I was still angry. And he sort of uncurled my hand and he put this £5 note in my hand and he said to me, when you grow up, Faye, find a job that makes you want to get up every single day. Otherwise, you're going to feel like this for the rest of your life. And at the time, I was probably too young, too immature, too cross to appreciate what he was saying. But as I kind of grew up a little bit and started to look at where I wanted my life and career to go, you know, his words just resonated so much with me. And I remember leaving dental school. I remember the day. It was the 19th of July, 2001. And I'd qualified as a hygienist and I had my new instruments in one hand and waving my certificate in the other. And I left dental school thinking, I've done it. I've found the thing that my granddad told me to find. I found the thing. And
you might
going to change the world.
More than £5 to do it.
I thought I'm going to save the world from gum disease. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to save the world. And yeah, I feel like I'm still on that mission these days.
what a great lesson. I think, yeah. The fact that it still stayed with you.
Absolutely.
Saves a lot.
Yeah.
And then I guess the natural question from that is, so that was the start of that part of your career. Mm. How did it work out? Do you feel like you succeeded in having that drive and that motivation that you had on that first day? Do you feel like that's carried on? What was those early years as a hygienist like? Did it go up and down? Were you always as positive as you are now and you were then?
I was definitely always as driven and as determined as I am today. I think there was an innocence back then. I think I was, nothing held me back then, nothing. And I actually believed that I could change the world. I believed I could save the world. I'd learned about this gum disease, this perio. I'd learned how to prevent it, how to treat it, how to manage it. I can change the world. And, you know, it was very difficult in the early days. We're talking 20, 22 years ago now. We were working 15-minute appointments without nurses and all of the things that we certainly consider to be very difficult working conditions nowadays. We did them anyway, and we kind of didn't really think about it back then. We just were doing our best all of the time, and everybody was at the same stage as well. So we were all just doing our best in these practices. And that was my only reference point at that time. I didn't have a different reference point. So I was doing the best that I could do in that situation with the resources that I had and was making a change. I was making a difference to these people. So I didn't have anything else to go by or anything else to reference, just my own standards and my own work ethic, which I knew was really strong. So I just enjoyed it. I had a ride. I enjoyed it. I think I like that although the working conditions, like I say, were now would seem almost unworkable. At the time, somebody said to me recently, pressure is a privilege, and a privilege that some people never get. And I think about that statement, and I think it is a privilege. That pressure was a privilege and remains a privilege, because actually it means that I'm getting to do the thing that I'm really good at, that I really care about, that that really drives and motivates me, I still get to do. So yeah, it was difficult. It's quite an isolated, quite lonely. I think that was the thing that I noticed early on. But nothing was going to get in my way. Nothing was going to stop me. Absolutely not, no.
And just listening to that journey, obviously you are at your now situation, but there's always a growth there. So what started that growth? Because you said it's always been there, but I'm just thinking about what you did with moving practices. Presumably you haven't stayed in the same place.
No. I had a couple of years in general practice, mostly national health, and very quickly decided I couldn't necessarily achieve the results that I was striving for within the confines of the national health. And at the time, there were lots of jobs being offered privately. So I left the NHS quite quickly, within a couple of years, actually. And then I started to, as you say, grow as a clinician and work out what was really important to me. And one of the things that I found really frustrating was that I would do a course of perio treatment, whatever we called it back then, probably still root planing or RSD. And perhaps I didn't get the results I wanted to. So I had to refer this patient on to a specialist. And that patient would come back, and I expected that they would have had surgery and systemic antibiotics and local delivery antibiotics, everything that could possibly have been thrown at them. And these patients were coming back and they'd had non-surgical treatment done. And I would say, well, how many appointments and what happened in these non-surgical appointments? And they would say, well, you know, this specialist has taught me how to clean properly. And then they cleaned the pockets out really well, and they planed the roots or whatever we said back in those days. And I remember thinking, well, that's what I do. I do non-surgical. What? And it genuinely was, and I was intrigued. I wanted to know, what is this man doing that I'm referring to that I'm not doing? And curiosity got the better of me. So I rang him up and said, can I come? I want to come and watch you. I want to know what you're doing. What am I not doing that you're doing? I've got the same pair of hands. I've got access to the equipment. I can have the time that I need. I've got these motivated pets. What am I not doing? And he said, well, actually, I'm looking for a hygienist at the moment. So cut a long story short, I ended up working for him. And one of the things that he insisted on was that I nurse for him. He paid me hygienist wages, but I had to nurse for him for 6 months. I had to be his dental nurse, aspirating for him. So that was in the room, and I experienced the standards that he aspired to. And it was a million miles away from where I was as a newly qualified. So I think that's where I really started to understand what impact getting the patient on board has on the results. And really, I started to realise what could be achieved in the absence of a knife and whatever, any other adjuncts that we might add
in there. Yes, the scalpel versus the toothbrush, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And he was very, very strict. You know, I worked for him for 10 years and by that point, by the end of it, I was probably 14 years qualified by that point, and I had to go to him every evening with the patient records, talk him through what had presented, what I'd done, why I'd made those decisions, how successful I thought it was. So wow. he really moulded me. And I look now, I was so lucky. I was so lucky to find him. And then in amongst that, I did various other kind of additional CPD. So I did a 6-month perio course at the Eastman at the time, traveling up and down every month. So I improved my clinical knowledge, improved my clinical skills, and I got to a stage where I thought, well, I've got the hard skills now. I can do this job.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I had the soft skills. So I think they're much better now. But again, back then, we were taught how to clean a tooth. We taught how to scale a tooth. But we weren't, I didn't feel particularly skilled if the patient didn't do what I asked them to do, or the patient cried, for instance, or, you know, the patient was a busy businessman who didn't have time for all this nonsense. I just want you to clean my teeth. And I was young. I just didn't have those skills. So off I went again, back to night school, and studied a diploma in counselling skills and behavioural therapy. And honestly, it is one of the best things I ever did. It catapulted my patient management skills into another stratosphere. Suddenly, I understood people. I knew how to speak to people. I knew how to listen to people. If you learn to listen to patients, they'll often give you all the answers that you need. So it taught me skills that I'd never encountered in my life before. So, you know, I felt like I was the full package by that point, so to speak, yeah.
Wow. That sounds great. I think sounds like you're really lucky to ultimately have a mentor, it sounds like, in that person that you work for, and to have the insight to identify where you needed to improve and then go and do something about that. I guess if there's other people that are listening that maybe haven't been as lucky as finding that person, or they're a bit unsure about where they want to go, maybe they're not quite satisfied with what they're doing, what advice would you give to somebody who's maybe feeling like you were in that situation, who then doesn't necessarily have the support at the moment?
Yeah, it's really difficult. But mentors are out there. So there's nothing to stop you from reaching out. It doesn't have to be a specialist that's, you know, carrying out groundbreaking work. Maybe it might be another hygienist in a practice down the road. I've always got somebody in my surgery. I get messages all the time saying I'm feeling, it tends to be one or the other. It either tends to be quite newly qualified, feeling a little bit lost. Mm-hmm. It's not quite what I expected it to be. Particularly the time constraints, I think they find especially difficult in those early years. Or else it tends to be hygienists who are maybe 20, 25 years into the career, who are actually perhaps feeling like they're being left behind a little bit. Everything's changed, the terminology's changed, all these new guidelines, and I'm finding them really difficult. How do you make them all work? We didn't have to do all this stuff when I qualified. How do you fit it all into an appointment? How do you make it work? So I tend to get one or the other coming in, and actually, 9 times out of 10, they sit in the surgery with me, and at the end of the day, they say, "Oh, well, I'm doing all of that. I'm doing the same as you." And sometimes it's just that reassurance, just to see somebody else, because it's so isolated. We don't ever see other clinicians' work, but having a platform or having somebody that you can talk to about your concerns or ask advice of, even if it's just to confirm, what would you do with this non-bleeding 6-millimeter pocket that, you know, the guidelines tell me to do this, but my instinct's telling me to do that. What, how, just talk it through. So my advice would be to find that mentor, or find that mate, or find somebody that you feel that you can confide in and talk to and get an honest opinion from. And if it doesn't have to be somebody that you know, just reach out. People that you see, you know, on the forums all the time that seem to know what they're talking about, just drop them a message. Yeah. Ask if you can go and sit in surgery with them. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised how many people are quite happy to do that.
Yeah. It's just a confidence in that first step.
Of course,
I guess
it
you
is.
Got to that point of, I'm sure there was a period of you thinking this, and then there was one day where, actually, I'm going to do something about this. Yeah. I'm going to ring this person up and speak to them. So, yeah, just having that confidence to...
Yeah, it is. And it's always difficult to make the first steps. It's always, you know, we talked about imposter syndrome, and everybody feels as though, particularly these days, in the days of social media, we all absolutely showcase our best work and our best side. And we don't necessarily talk about the dark side of things. So don't be fooled to think that everybody, even those of us with a high profile, don't struggle sometimes and need that support as well.
Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting point that you make there, because actually, you know, we've invited you on this podcast for lots of different reasons. And I certainly made contact with you way before this podcast was actually out there. And I made contact with you because I think you, I'm going to use the word brave, I think you were brave enough to write about your General Dental Council fitness to practice experience. Now, that's quite a big thing to write about. And I wondered whether you would be happy to perhaps talk about that for our listeners who may not have necessarily seen your article.
Yeah, of course. Took me 6 years to write it. So it was very brave. It felt brave. It also felt there was an element of, I guess, it was cathartic as well. But it took a long time for that, because certainly when it happened, one of the problems I had was that I didn't speak up about it and I didn't say anything about it. And that got me into a whole hot mess, really. I think when these things happen, they're so unexpected. And I think particularly when the type of personality that I was, which is I'm all in or all out, I'm either giving 110% to what I'm doing or I'm not doing it at all. And I think when you are kind of innocent and driven and, you know, I actually believed I was going to save the world from gum disease. And so I was trying my hardest and trying my best in absolutely everything I did. So the shock, I guess, of realising that I'd done something wrong, however unintentional it was heartbreaking for me, really heartbreaking. And particularly because I'd started to build, only started, but just a little bit of a profile, certainly in my smaller community for myself. So admitting that this person that had professed to, you know, want to be the best in everything she does had got something wrong was really difficult for me to kind of accept. So what happened in my case was that the practice had recently had a revamp, and the website was being revamped as part of it. I was asked to write a piece about what I did and why I did it and why patients should come and see us and come and see me, which I did quite happily. And I don't doubt for a second that it was my own fault, because my word count will definitely have been over, because anybody that knows me knows that I say far more than I need to say. And off it went to the marketing company, and the marketing company edited it, I assume, and made it more concise than what I'd written. I didn't know they were doing that, but they also didn't hide that. So this is not me passing blame to anybody. With hindsight, what I should have done is, when that was published on the website, gone on the website, which I did. But obviously what I did was look at my picture and decide whether I looked nice and if they'd got my best side or not, rather than rereading what I'd written. I probably read the first couple of lines and didn't need to read anything else. But lo and behold, what they'd done in that process had put just one tiny little sentence in the middle of, "Is a hygienist, she's this, she's that, she's the other," that said, "Face specialises in treating anxious patients with periodontal disease, with gum disease." And I was blissfully unaware. The website was probably up for about 9 months before anything happened with it. The dreaded letter landed on the doormat, which said, "We've received some information about you." And they copied, it was anonymous, so they hid the name, but they copied they sent me the email that they'd been sent. And it was a fellow professional who'd sent an email saying, "We've got grave concerns about this girl. She's parading herself as a specialist," which was everything I wasn't doing. And the emotional roller coaster that week was remains really hard to kind of process, I guess, is the word. And the weeks that followed that were among the hardest weeks of my professional career.
I don't doubt. I mean, I think we really mustn't underestimate the power of receiving such a letter from your regulator there. So, I mean, that's clearly a big thing, isn't it? I mean, that's a colossal life event in your career.
It was colossal. And, you know, the irony's not lost on me. What I was being accused of, being unfit and leading the public astray and any sort of malpractice, the irony wasn't lost on me, because actually what the process did was took me to a place where actually that's exactly what happened. I did become what I consider unsafe, in terms of I was so preoccupied and so distraught about what was going on outside of the dental surgery that I found myself in situations where I didn't feel in control in that surgery. And, you know, one example that I gave when I wrote the article was a patient who I'd seen regularly every 3 months. He was allergic to mint, and I gave him a pre-op mouthwash with mint in it. And it's only because he said, "I can smell mint. Has this got mint in it?" And that was my turning point. That was my moment where, I guess, panic set in. I think I'd spent so long pretending that I was pretending that it wasn't affecting me, and feeling like I needed to project myself still in this very professional way. But that was the moment that I thought, that's it. I've got no fight left. I can't do this anymore. Mm. And actually, I don't want to do it anymore.
Thank you very much for sharing it.
Yeah, thank you. I think, it's something that we don't talk about, something that nobody wants to happen to them or to anybody else. But if you don't mind... So what was the process from that? Because I know we're saying that people don't really talk about it, but for people that don't know anybody that's been through that experience, that don't have an idea of what happens, what actually was the process from that? Because it's not a straightforward, you know, a few days kind of thing. It's a big, drawn-out thing.
It's a long... So the process is that initially, or it was at the time, it might have changed now, at the time, there's lots of gathering of information about you. So they're sort of building a picture, if you like, about you, and deciding whether this is a case that needs to go before a fitness to practice panel or whether some other sanction would be appropriate. And I think for me, I immediately rang my indemnity. I was very lucky. And I would certainly say to any listeners, when you're choosing your indemnity, find out exactly what they would do in that situation. I think a lot of indemnity suppliers these days who, you know, maybe they offer a cheaper package, but actually, unless there's money exchanging hands or you're being sued in some way, actually supporting you through a fitness to practice might not be covered in your package. Thankfully, my indemnity did cover that, and it was 11 o'clock at night and I rang them and the crisis guy was there and talked me through it all. Otherwise, it had been a Friday night and I would have been stuck. And I remember it vividly because it was my birthday when the letter came. I know. It's a tough week. So the process really then is that I signed everything over to my indemnity and they very much took it on, and you know, you just have lots of contacts, lots of gathering of information. They wrote to the people that I work with, and you know, you've got all of a sudden, you're not this passionate individual that's desperately trying to make the world a better place. You're somebody on a piece of paper who has, you know, broken the rules, and you're in big trouble for it, and you're being judged by somebody who knows nothing about you. And that's really hard. And some of the questions that the people I work for were asked about, you know, how do you view my professionalism at work? How do I behave outside of work? You're suddenly being judged and you can't help but think, oh, crikey, what if I got drunk at the Christmas party? And what if somebody says that? And yeah. Now they go, you know, and I think you do lose, you do lose perspective a little bit in these situations. And, you know, you kind of see the worst possible outcome. And that really, really plays and really messes. And so the indemnity did most of the work for me, most of the contact with the GDC. I would hate to think that it was me that had to gather that information because I didn't even understand half of what it was that they wanted. Mm. In the end, I was one of the lucky ones in that I didn't go to panel in the end. They decided that they'd gathered enough information. They had enough evidence to support a very big slap on the wrist. And so I didn't have to go to panel. And so essentially that's it. It's over and done with. Off you go and don't misbehave again. Mm. But of course, it doesn't end there, does it? I certainly had an element. Now, looking back, I think I had an element of some kind of post-traumatic stress and actually, you know, decided for me that I was going to leave the industry because the fear that I might go through that again. Bearing in mind, I really did hit rock bottom. I got to a point where I couldn't go to work anymore. The fear that I would go back to that dark place where I wasn't safe anymore filled me. It just filled me with, I just didn't want to put myself in that situation again. So I decided to remove myself from the register, but actually just at the right time, an older guy that I'd been helping who'd come to me, his complaint was really that he hadn't had the confidence to kiss his wife in 27 years, I think it was, 23 years, I think it was. And we'd worked through all sorts with him. One of my mantras is treat the person, not the perio. That's what I talk about all the time. What's behind the perio? Why has this person got perio? Why haven't they had it treated? What's led to it? What else do we need to address before we get to addressing the perio? And I'd helped him through all sorts. And he'd written a letter and the practice had posted it onto me. And this letter began, it still makes me emotional when I think about it. This letter started, "Dear Faye, today I kissed my wife." And you know, it was kind of this outpouring of gratitude for what I'd achieved with him. And I don't think he'll ever know that was my moment where I kind of picked myself up and dusted myself down and thought, do you know what? I think I've still got something to give. I think there's something still in me. And, you know, it's not adversity, is it? It's how we respond to it. What's that phrase my grandpa always used to say? The same water that softens a potato hardens the egg. And, you know, it's true. It's the environment. Yeah. It's how we see it, how we address it. So from there, that became very much a springboard for me. And I decided that I was going to use my experience to hopefully positively influence and help people. Because I think when you have a profile, you can choose to use that profile in a negative way or in a positive way. Yeah, and for me, if I could help one person not to get to the stage that I got to going through that process, then that was success for me. And that's certainly why I decided to write the article when I had a little bit of headspace in COVID and a little bit of breathing space and thought, right, I'm going to write this up. Yeah, it was hard. It was hard to do. It was hard to write up. But like I say, cathartic. And I think what also really helped was the outpouring, the people that contacted me after that article, Julia, you being one of them, but so many people, they hadn't even necessarily, I mean, lots of them had been through similar or were going through similar processes, but some of them were just really touched by the honesty, I guess, the kind of candid honesty of how difficult it is and what happens and how you might be feeling and this encouragement to reach out and not be alone. And that support really helped as well to at least feel like I'd done some good maybe with it.
thank you so much, Faye, for sharing that, because that's, like Josh has said, this is a big life event in a dental career. So I think to share those nuances of your experience, I think are really very, very valuable to our listeners. And to that effect, then, I'd like to ask you about your involvement in a fairly new charity that's out there to support dental professionals called Confidental. Now, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, Confidential is, you're right, quite a new initiative, but one that is very welcomed and is such an important initiative to have, something we've never had before. So Confidential was set up, it's a crisis line, essentially a helpline and a crisis line for, initially it was dentists, it's recently been opened up to hygienists and therapists, and I believe they're in the process of opening it up to the whole dental profession, although that's not happened quite yet, mostly because they have to make sure they've got all the resources, if the more people that they open it up to. But I think it's in the process of. But initially, it was set up to. It was set up by a couple of dentists, one of whom who had all sorts of problems himself and didn't feel that there was anywhere for him to turn to people who specifically understood the industry. So they set up this helpline, essentially, which is manned 24/7, 24 hours a day by dentists. So people who do understand the industry and do understand what you might be going through. And it's there to help dentists and now dental hygienists and dental therapists who are struggling. And that might not be that they're at crisis point like I was at, but they are, the volunteers are trained. They're trained in suicide awareness and you know, they're trained in counselling. And
this isn't necessarily for people who are going through a fitness to practice
not
thing.
At all, no.
This is, you know, out there in the general practice, in whatever dental setting you might be working in.
And not even just dental settings. So some people might call who maybe they've got financial worries outside of the dental practice, but that's going to impact on their ability to practice safely. So they might have, you know, they might be going through a divorce, a really difficult time outside of dentistry, and they need to talk to somebody who understands and has got time. And I was lucky enough to meet some of the volunteers recently when I went and joined them for the study day. And honestly, I take my hat off. I must take a moment to just give credit to them, because they're dentists, they're practicing. Some are retired. Most of them are still practicing now. They've got busy lives. But they've all got their own stories and for whatever reason have felt that they want to help others in the industry. So, you know, we didn't have such a crisis line when I had my investigation, but we do have it now. And I feel really passionately that I want people to know about that helpline. Don't get to crisis point. Use it like a helpline. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you might have just had a really bad day at the office. Maybe there's problems going on with co-workers, whatever it might be. Pick the phone up and they can talk to somebody, and they're there to help. And you know, they invited me down to speak because they'd opened it up to hygienists and therapists. So my role really that day was, can you talk us through some of the problems that hygienists and therapists might come across so that we're better prepared if and when we pick up the phone to them? And actually what came out of the end of that day was, crikey, you're working as hard as the dentists are and you've got the same troubles that we've all got. And actually, you know, we don't need any different training at all. So it was an opportunity, though, to see the inner workings of a charity that has been set up from a place of love and concern for professionals within our industry. And they need commending and supporting for that, in my opinion.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, for sure.
Really important.
Yeah,
charity.
I mean, it's a wonderful facility, and I think, like you say, it's great that they're opening it up to the rest of the dental team.
Yeah, and I don't think you can underestimate the value of somebody of dental knowledge.
Absolutely.
Because it's fine going home, talking to your partner, talking to your friends, whatever. But somebody that really gets it, I'm sure that's a complete game changer in terms of the support for those people.
Yeah, when I think about my FTP, it was this sense that you were the only one, that you were alone. I felt like I was the only person that had got anything wrong. And I felt like I was the worst person as well. And that loss of perspective then compounds the emotions that you're feeling. And, you know, before you know it, everything spiraled out of control. So I think having somebody at the end of a phone who would have been able to say, actually, you know, I went through this, or, you know, I know somebody that this happened to or that happened to, or let's put it in perspective, look at your... look at what you've done compared to some of these things that we know about. And it, you know, just that balance, I guess, would have helped. I think it would have helped anyway. Empathy is, you know, really valuable in these situations, isn't it?
So we've talked about quite a lot of different initiatives that you're involved in. And you've talked about your passion for behaviour change and treating your patients as a whole, and that seems to have got you into all sorts of different things. So being an opinion leader for different companies. And one of the things that stood out for me as well was that you were a dental advisor to the athletes at the Commonwealth Games. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's the story there? How did that come about? What were you doing?
Oh, I mean, honestly, for anybody listening, you've got to do it. If you get the opportunity, you've got to do it. It was one of the best things I've ever done. So I answered an advert that I don't even know where I saw it, maybe online, maybe one of the associations put the advert out saying the Commonwealth Games are coming to Birmingham. And so what they do is they set up a polyclinic, and within that polyclinic, there are surgeons and doctors and opticians and, you know, every discipline of medical care you could imagine. There's x-ray machines in there, MRI scanners. There's absolutely everything in this polyclinic. And one of the elements, of course, is dentistry. So there was a call out for a dental hygienist to go and support the athletes as well. And I thought, well, that's got my name written all over it. So answered this advert and went through this whole interview process. And yeah, was lucky enough to be selected as one of the hygienists or therapists that were there to support the athletes. And what was really, it just struck me as an opportunity to shine a light on our profession and the good that we can do. And, you know, we talk about all the time about putting the mouth back in the body. And it just struck me that this demographic of patient were the ideal demographic to understand why dental health is so important to systemic health. I mean, you know, these people are working with micro margins. You're talking about tenths of seconds are the difference between being gold medalists and being nothings. And, you know, they trained for 4 years for this. So I have to say they were the best demographic of patient I have ever worked with. You describe chronic inflammation and how it travels around the body. And, you know, imagine if that was in your leg or whatever, and why you wouldn't be performing at your absolute best. And they came back the next day. I mean, they were the most immaculate mouths I've ever seen. They were absolutely brilliant. And where I expected my role to be lots of old school scaling, and because there's a whole, you'll have seen, particularly the runners, the female runners, you see them and they've got these amazing colours in their hair and they've got the national flag on the nails and all the rest of it. So there's a whole kind of beauty section going on in this polyclinic as well. So I expected, oh, I'll be doing lots of cleaning and lots of kind of stain removal. But actually that wasn't the case at all. Particularly, I think, with the Commonwealth, a lot of these countries don't really have a healthcare system to speak of. So this was their one opportunity, my one opportunity to get access to them. It was surprising how little knowledge they had in that area, in that field, but how interested they were in it once we started talking about it. So very quickly, I realised my role was about education, was increase their knowledge, teach them everything that you can teach, particularly the ones that come from the smaller Commonwealth countries where there isn't a healthcare system. So prevention's even more important because actually they can't get access to dentists as and when they come up against problems. And I think I assumed the problems would be caries because of the diet and lots of sports drinks and the frequency of which they have to intake calories. But actually, it was a lot more about inflammation. I've never seen so much inflammation and bleeding and gingivitis and early perio in a group of individuals that you would expect would be in pristine health. So it ended up not being what I expected it to be. However, I met the most amazing people. I laughed my way. It was 3.5 weeks of utter joy and laughter and everything in between. And, you know, they taught me so much. As much as I taught them, they taught me about their lives and you know, what happens in their countries and what they're exposed to. And the dental truck and the opticians, because there's very few opticians in some of these countries, we were definitely the busiest. We worked a lot harder than the others did, but it was a real opportunity to shine a light on what we do with people who, you know, some people had never even heard of dental hygienists before. So it remains one of the highlights of my career, and I will definitely be doing it again. If only I could speak French, I'd be making my way to Paris for the Olympics next. I'm working on it. Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, really brilliant. Yeah.
You're known for setting up a very successful study group. Yes. In your local area. So what led you to set this up, and what do you think the benefits are to people to be part of something like this sort of group?
So what led me to pick it up really was this drive that I have in supporting other individuals. It's become my lane. I don't know why it became my lane. I don't know how it happened or why it happened, but it's very much mental health in the industry and supporting of other clinicians has very much become my lane. It's the thing that I probably speak about more than anything now. And certainly the thing that people seem to turn to me about. I'm not sure. Maybe it's the counselling and the behavioural therapy. I don't know what it is. So what I noticed, particularly on the forums, and particularly post-COVID, actually, there wasn't a lot of good that came out of COVID. But one of the really good things that came out of COVID, because collectively, as a nation, as a planet, we all had a little bit of a meltdown together, and everybody was going, because we're quite tribal, aren't we? We don't like to be the only one that's suffering. But because we all went through this together, suddenly people started saying, oh, well, I'm not okay. Oh, well, I'm not okay either, and I'm not okay. Mm. And, you know, it might have been financial. It might have been that they were struggling with loss of identity. It might be whatever it was. We were all having our own little struggle.
It was definitely more acceptable to say that you were having a bad day.
Absolutely. Everybody was having a bad day all at the same time. So everybody started saying, oh, guess what? I'm not okay. And I think that's the good thing that came out of COVID. I think we weren't really even talking about mental health before COVID. And now everybody talks about mental health and whether they're having a good day, bad day. So that's amazing. And I was seeing on the forums more and more individuals that were coming on and saying they were struggling. And I just thought, we just need to sit around with a glass of wine or a coffee. We need to just talk this through. I got so much support from peers throughout my career, and I feel more and more now with the accessibility of the forums that perhaps the more newly qualified hygienists and therapists aren't networking the way that we networked because we had to. And it's quick and easy to put on a forum, what do you think I should do about this situation? But yeah. Look beyond that, crikey, there's some support that needs to be there. So I wanted to support people, which is where the study group Contemporary Hygienists came from, myself and Claire. But also I felt this sense that clinicians practice so defensively these days. And, you know, I'm a great example of why that needs to be. But I felt that they were practicing so defensively that maybe they weren't expressing themselves or weren't reaching their potential because they were so held back by what could go wrong and what might go wrong. And I just wanted to have a platform where individuals could see, at least see their potential, because these forums can be quite negative places. We tend to not go on there and shout about all the great things in the world. We tend to go on there and say, this terrible thing happened at work today. So I wanted a much more positive experience for our study club members. So I didn't want any more hotel rooms with beige carpets and beige curtains and death by PowerPoint. So we chose really funky kind of pubs or venues, and let's have a drink and let's have some nice food. And sometimes we didn't even know what we were going to talk about. We tried to kind of structure it, but it nearly always went off in a completely different place. And oh, the positivity that comes from the study groups, the lovely messages of gratitude that we've had afterwards. And the number, there was one rep that came actually, it's not a sponsored study group, but this rep came along anyway to give some free samples out. And actually he contacted us and said, guess what? I've handed my notice in and I'm going back to being a hygienist after listening to your study group. I don't want to be a rep anymore. I want to go back. I forgot how great it was. And wow. Yeah, I know, absolutely. So I wanted to create a safe space where people could come and cry, but also, you know, let's just brainstorm. If you could have anything in the world, what would you be? What would you do? Right, how are we going to get you there? What are we going to do? And, you know, with our new members, we always start with a jar where we get them to write down, where would you like to be in a year from now? And don't think I haven't got all those little bits of paper with the dates on. And, you know, let's see where you are a year from now. So I wanted it to be, as much as it was supportive of mental health issues, a really kind of positive place to be as well. And it's been very successful. I think I could run this study club in every city in the UK, to be honest with you. But again, there's nothing to stop anybody from just putting a note out, a few kind of hygienists or therapists in the area, do you fancy getting together and you know, see what we can bring to the table. So
we've talked about lots of different things, but we always like to be a little bit random on this podcast. So I'm going to ask you a question, put you on the spot. If you were going to be a dental product, what dental product do you think you'd be and why?
Oh my gosh. That is a really hard question. Well, it would have to be something that works really hard, because that is okay. Me, my work ethic almost to a fault. So it'd have to be some kind of brush, because I think they do the most work in there. And I think I might choose an interspace brush, particularly a super slim interspace brush.
Okay.
And I think I'd choose that because they are surprising little suckers that actually you don't know their worth until you start using them. You don't realise how something so small can have such a big impact. And I think that is me in a nutshell, actually. And dental hygienists, until you start seeing dental hygienists and dental therapists, you don't actually know how much impact they can have. Dental disease is preventable. It's absolutely preventable. And I don't think there has ever been a more exciting time to be a dental hygienist and therapist. Prevention's what we do. That's absolutely what we do. And you know, you look through the generations, we are getting somewhere. I think my granddad didn't have any teeth. My parents have a mouthful of fillings, but they kept the teeth. Mm-hmm. My generation, me and my sisters, we kind of got fillings, but not too many. And then I look at my daughter, my 15-year-old, and other teenagers who don't have any any disease in there at all. And I know that you know, we're very lucky where we are in our lifestyle, but it is happening. We are very slowly getting somewhere with the prevention of dental disease. So I don't think it's ever been a better or more exciting time to be a hygienist or therapist. So yeah, get your sleeves rolled up, get in where it's dirty, be a subgingival interspace brush. That's what I'd be.
Perfect. Well,
knee
I think
deep.
That's a wonderful way to end. So thank you, Faye, so much for coming.
Yes, thank
for
you, Faye.
And speaking
it's been
to us.
Really great to have you on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for giving me a platform and in which to talk about my experience. And I hope that, you know, some of your listeners are able to take some of what I've said and use it to hopefully help them through either difficult times or just reach their potential and look beyond the kind of four walls of what they live day to day and just look at what else could they do, what else is out there for them, because it's definitely there for the taking.
Thank you. If you've been inspired by that episode, did you know that the Eastman Dental Hospital Education Centre provide training for the whole dental team? Follow us on social media or search for the Eastman Dental Hospital Education Centre to find out more.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. We would love to hear your suggestions for future guests. Remember to follow us on social media using hashtag the Eastman Dental Podcast. And if you like what you hear, please like, share, subscribe and listen out for future episodes.